All right, welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. All right, in this segment, we're going to go out to Denver and bring in our main man, Mark Slareth, from his crib in Denver. All right, guys, let's get to it. Time for a big story presented by Hyundai. All right, Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk has suggested that the NFL consider the possibility of going all the way out to a remote island, perhaps, some coronavirus-free zone, and play its NFL season. I think I want to pick up from where I said in the last segment. I think Las Vegas might be another option even for the NFL. Again, obviously, I'm someone that really wants sports to come back, and we need to do everything in our power to make sure we have these football and basketball seasons. Do we think, we'll start with you, Marcellus, thoughts on Mike Florio's idea of the NFL playing in an isolated coronavirus-free zone, wherever the hell that is?
Yeah, this is even a more daunting task than the NBA trying to put together its season, which I think both of them should try as hard as they can to make this happen as a reality. We all want it. But the NFL, woo, you're talking about a different animal in terms of just the 1,800-plus players, essential personnel, coaches, staff, therapists, doctors. I mean, you're talking about the line, that population of people who need to be quarantined or in this bubble area for the NFL, more difficult. On top of the fact that just physically to play the sport and pragmatically to perform the sport is going to be more difficult because it's not as recreational as a basketball court or just having a basketball venue and at times multiple basketball venues under one umbrella. That doesn't happen in the NFL. It's a stadium, it's a football field, and it's very difficult to kind of replicate that experience. But not impossible. Looking forward to seeing what can come from this. And this is just the first iteration, the first mindset around this conversation. So we know that more will come in detail and hopefully come to life.
Yeah, I just think this is the dumbest idea I've ever heard of. I mean, first off, where are you going to go? What bubble are you going to put everybody in? It's 53 guys on a roster, 14 practice squad guys, 20 coaches. Like, we're all going to sequester in some corona-free zone. Where are we going to practice? How are we going to get all these people together? How are we going to get the games off? First of all, can we just let the quarantine stuff have its effect first before we decide to ship us off to the Mars to play football? I mean, this to me is, again, fear-mongering at its best. Like, let's capitalize on clicks because let's write a story about fear on something there's no even factual basis on. This is just a dumb idea. Stupid.
Mark, you forced me to do something I don't think I've ever done in my life. I'm going to defend Mike Florio. And I don't like Mike Florio, but I'm going to defend him. Listen, man, we put a man on the moon. I think his name was Neil Armstrong. Mm-hmm. We've done some amazing things in this country. We went back 200 years. Somebody say, oh, man, a plane is going to fly you from California to New York. And, you know, there's all kinds of incredible things that we've done. Smart people are going to figure out how we play football, basketball, and baseball this year. And I don't really think it's that hard. And again, I don't have, to me, when you're in a situation like this, what I don't like doing, and again, I can't stand Florio. I think he's a phony fraud. But I don't like shouting down bad ideas. There are no bad ideas. Throw it up there. Get the conversation going. Look, hopefully the Kansas City Chiefs can play right there in Arrowhead Stadium, and the Denver Broncos can play right at Mile High Stadium and all those things. But I'm not going to question anybody that's like, here's plan B, C, D, E, and F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. Come up with all the plans you can come up with to play football this year because it is important, I think, to American society and culture. And so Florio's idea is a little bit silly, but I'm not going to knock the man for a silly idea. It's worth considering anything, and I do think that, and one thing we're going to have to get over, because there's been some blowback about athletes getting tested, and can the rest of the public get tested as frequently or as easily as athletes? I got to be honest, I don't have a problem with it. And if they come to some measures where athletes are getting tested more often and getting perhaps more efficient medical care so they can play these games, I won't have a problem with it. Marcellus?
Yeah, look, a couple things come to mind, man. Obviously, necessity is the mother of invention. We're going to figure something out because we need to figure something out. And this is just the beginning of that. If I'm talking to Schlereff and everyone else who really heard this idea and was like, whoa, it had to roll their eyes. I felt the same way. But we have to respect that your imagination is just a seed that becomes that reality. We have to follow as Jason went through the alphabet. And I think he missed a letter there, though. But he got through the alphabet, basically, right? We have to start somewhere. We're going to start somewhere. And trust me, wherever we go, we're going to laugh at where we started. But right now, we need to continue this thought experiment to make sure we get us some football.
Yeah, I'm okay with that as long as we go ahead and let the quarantine play out first and see where we are after that before we start throwing ludicrous ideas about playing on Mars. Listen, I'm for anything that keeps football alive because I want to see it and I love it. It's the lifeblood that has provided for my family. So I love football, but for crying out loud, I want to see what we do as a country, what we do as a kind of a community, a world community first to see exactly what happens before we start, before we start canceling things and moving things to Timbuktu.
All right, welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. All right, let's don't waste any time. Let's go out to the Bay Area. Rick Bucher joining us live from the Bay, from his crib. Let's move to LeBron James. And LeBron, what's more important for LeBron? Finishing the season, and there's a lot of conversation about how we can finish this NBA season. LeBron has been on record. He doesn't want to play unless he can play in front of fans, and there's been a lot of conversation about playing in front of empty arenas. What's more important for LeBron, Marcellus, finishing the season or playing in front of fans?
Oh, absolutely, finishing the season. Even him talking about he wouldn't play in front of fans, he started to walk that back and kind of put it more in the light of jest because he realized that may be a necessary measure to get this season going. But at his age, knowing that he can see his expiration date, no matter how distant it is, he still has more basketball behind him than in front of him. So he's counting down these numbers. And at 35, you don't want to waste opportunity. And this is really terrible timing for him, as he even talked about, because it takes forever to get into shape. And it takes no time to get out of it. And that's what LeBron is scared of. And I'm sure he's scared for his own team that they may have missed a golden opportunity because of this interruption.
It's not finishing the season, so by default, it is a desire to play in front of fans. But the desire to play in front of fans is really a cover for, I don't want to play these playoffs when I know I'm going to be at a disadvantage. You're right. The age is a factor. And while we may look at him and say, man, he doesn't look 35, he knows he's 35, and he knows that he's calibrated things very carefully this season in order to not look 35. But the reality is 2 months off, having to start from zero, playing with one of the oldest teams in the league, he knows that their chances, he's now at a disadvantage in terms of being able to get this done. And he looks much better if there is no resumption of the season. And we just look at it and say, well, LeBron had the Lakers in first in the West. If it hadn't been interrupted, if it hadn't ended, he very likely would have gotten a championship in Los Angeles, whether he ends up getting one down the road or not. So coming back, LeBron's always been very careful to make sure everything's skewed into his advantage. This is one situation. If we come back and play at his age with his team, he will not have that advantage.
We may have to circle back to this topic tomorrow because you have blown my mind, Rick. And I need more time to marinate on what you just said. But I want you first to clarify why you think LeBron James is afraid to play basketball. I just don't buy that. I think this layoff, I don't think that makes him fearful of finishing this season. And so you clarify that, and then Marcellus, you respond however you want, because I just need time to think about this. You've blown my mind.
Well, he's talked about how everybody says that this layoff is a positive, and it's not. He said on the podcast that it's not. At his age, getting 2 months off at this stage, physically, it's starting from zero. And so if going up against a Giannis Antetokounmpo or a Kawhi Leonard or a Paul George, Marcellus, you can speak to this. The way you prepared to play when you were 31 and 32 in Jacksonville was a far cry different than when you first came into the NFL. That's what LeBron's looking at, and he realizes I'm at a disadvantage here. I could look bad. We could get knocked out early. He doesn't want to run up against that when, if they don't play again, we simply look at what he's accomplished to this point, which has been very impressive.
Yeah, Rick is hitting it right on the head in terms of, I think the Lakers have the second oldest roster. So let's just talk about a collective age being older than most of the league and whoever they're going to face going forward. And think about your own family. Think about yourself, whether you're Whitlock, myself, anybody who's getting up there in age. When do you feel your best? After you warm up and you got things rolling. When do you feel your worst? When you first wake up after you rested. Guess what? LeBron's like, y'all out here saying, since I'm old, I need rest and this is going to help me. It's just the opposite effect. It's going to be just like him waking up for the first time, but it's going to be latter season, if not playoff time. He needs time to get this engine revving and rolling again. And that's what LeBron is trying to whisper, but it's starting to come out loud and clear.
All right, listen, we got to move on and get to Uncle Jimmy. I'm going to end this segment by saying something very inappropriate. That's what I'm known for. I'm sorry, apologizing up front. But y'all did kind of make me understand your point of view. You guys are both married. Those of us that are single, this coronavirus has me afraid. When I get back out to Wally's and get mingling around, I am worried about restarting my engine, and my performance early will probably be shaky. So if there's any ladies out there, you got to cut me the benefit of the slack. I'm older. It's going to take me time to get back in rhythm. I get where you guys are coming from. All right, stick around. Uncle Jimmy's nuts.
1 minute. 1 minute.
Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. We're joined by Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports, the best sports writer working today. We're going to talk about... We're joined from Dan's crib in Detroit. We're going to talk about the HBO documentary, The Scheme. I just laid it out for you. This documentary went after the NCAA and the fraudulence of amateurism. Marcellus, what was your takeaway from the documentary?
Oh, well done documentary. I think one is just the corruption and discovering corruption is mind-boggling. Like, watching the trail of the FBI's investigation, and no one walked into this documentary leaving the same in terms of understanding the details of this case and how it flipped. I think that was part of it. But I think also in the grand scope was just this whole concept of amateurism. And if you look at it, how it warps our relationship with capitalism, and let's just be real, it takes even the greatest men of character, the greatest people of character, as they wrestle in this slop and try their damnedest to stay clean. And it's almost an impossible task. And I think just because of the lens of amateurism, how we have to look at collegiate sports really warps our reality. And it really turns a lot of characters into people that they don't necessarily see themselves becoming.
Dan, what was your takeaway?
Well, I think Marcellus makes a great point about the capitalism, because I say often amateurism is trying to stop the wheels of capitalism. It's saying that people who have value don't have value. And that's just not going to work in America. So you create an underground economy because of these rules. And the rules are just concepts. They're bogus. People are only amateurs at things they aren't any good at. You're an amateur cook. And then if you get good at it, you start your own restaurant. So these kids, these basketball players are great athletes. They are good at what they're doing. But the amateurism creates the whole problem, and I think that's what you look at. If you look at the crimes, the supposed crimes that went on here, almost none of it is a crime, except for this one rule that only applies to basketball and football, basically, that creates it. If this is a young recording artist, if this is a young business entrepreneur, if this is anything else, none of this stuff would be a crime. It's only a crime because the NCAA has found a way to profit off this ancient concept of amateurism. And I think that's really when you look at it. I mean, the story is basically Christian Dawkins' story. It's told through him. Some people are going to like him, some aren't. But I think at the end, you look at it and go, gosh, this was an unbelievable farce that all of this went into. What criminals were we trying to catch here?
Marcellus, I want to ask you, friends of mine last night that I played football with at Ball State, we were texting back and forth. Some felt exploited as college athletes. I didn't. I feel like there's a handful of really elite college athletes that should be paid. Your experience as a college athlete, did you feel exploited? And do you think everybody should be paid in college football and basketball?
Oh, the trillion-dollar question, I think, there, because I don't have a pragmatic approach, a realistic approach on how you can pay everyone on a level playing field. What happens to those lesser sports and those lesser athletes in that same conversation of paying athletes? I didn't feel exploited. I went to a small school. I thought I got a tremendous education. My situation is, I think, unique to those who are in the pros or go through the collegiate experience. I think that my surroundings made me feel like I had gotten proper reception in terms of room, board, education, and networking, et cetera. But for most guys, I think that they feel on the other side of this. You look at it, and being at my school as well, Dan brought up a great point. I went to school with Lauryn Hill, the famous rapper, and it was crazy being in class with her, and she would be there for 2 weeks, a month, and then she would disappear to film a movie or do an album and then come right back to class like nothing happened. Meanwhile, coming back to class looking a lot richer, living a better life than all of us, but she wasn't deemed an amateur at what she did. She became a professional rapper and was able to reap those rewards. Meanwhile, a guy like me who was doing great on the football field but was deemed an amateur was sitting there broke with his mouth wide open looking at her in envy. So it's kind of hard to really reconcile those two worlds.
Dan, move us to a new topic. I want to ask you this. My takeaway watching the documentary, why I'm critical of Christian Dawkins, it's because of those coaches that had the assistant coaches and the Jim Gattos who had their life ruined because Christian Dawkins brought them into this probe or FBI sting. Do you feel sorry for the assistant coaches, the Book Richardsons, the Chuck Persons, the Tony Blands, that got involved in this thing because of Christian Dawkins? Do you feel sorry for them?
I do. I feel somewhat sorry for their plight because, first off, they're doing a job, and it's a well-defined job of what they're supposed to be doing on these staffs. But mainly the crimes that they committed or were convicted of or pled guilty to just don't really feel like crimes. You talk about the bribery the assistant coaches got. They weren't in position to ever deliver on this supposed bribe. They were getting paid to steer players on their roster to Christian Dawkins and the FBI undercover agents. They really wouldn't have any power over them, as Christian says. That deal is made directly with the player or his family, not some assistant coach. So if I say to you, Jason, I'm going to give you $10,000, get me a meeting with Donald Trump. And you say, I can't get you a meeting with Donald Trump. And I say, don't worry about it. Just take the $10,000. And you do no effort at trying to get me that meeting. And this is somehow ruled illegal. I don't know if this would be illegal, but let's just say, what'd you do? You didn't really do anything except some sucker was willing to give you $10,000 for something you couldn't do. And now your entire career is blown up. You're a felon. You struggle to get a new job. You've been embarrassed. You had the FBI kick down your door and come in. These crimes are nothing. You talked about Marty Blazer earlier. Marty Blazer stole millions of dollars from people. And he got off, basically, got probation, because he turned in a bunch of guys who either accepted thousands or gave away thousands. Didn't steal anything, didn't really get bribed, nothing really happened. So I feel bad for these guys that this is the extent of what has happened to them when you're still looking for a victim to this supposed crime.
Marcellus, did you have any sympathy for these assistants?
Not really, no. Look, the end game obviously makes you feel a little sympathetic for him, but their initial relationship with Christian and all the ongoings before even this probe started, obviously that wasn't fully above board. Now, the conversation of is it a crime in the first place? Obviously, we're having that conversation, but let's still, you don't know Christian in those worlds and in that scope unless you were doing something not above board. But like the coaches, like most people involved with this, they went down a crooked road as straight as possible. And I think that because of their relationship and the familiarity and the intimacy of that relationship, they finally got caught and discovered. Not necessarily the worst thing, but obviously something that was unethical by NCAA rules.
Marcellus, I'm going to stay with you and Dan, but I want you to answer this question as well. There was a lot of talk about Rick Pitino when this all was going on. He's the dirtiest man in college basketball, allegedly. Obviously, Will Wade and Sean Miller don't look good after the playing of the tapes. Marcellus, Christian Dawkins said something that I truly, truly believe, and I don't care how people think it comes off. I have no respect for the big-time Division I coaches who make millions of dollars who aren't trying to figure out ways to share that wealth with the players. The guys that aren't trying to share the wealth are the guys I have no respect for. Christian Dawkins said it. It speaks to my heart. That is exactly what I believe. Marcellus, your reaction, then Dan.
Yeah, when he said that, it did take me aback. You had to really dissect that to understand where he was coming from. There's one thing to have that in your character, in your desires, but then how do you fulfill that? I think that's where it gets murky in terms of NCAA and their rule book, et cetera. But I do side with him in terms of someone who's looking out and saying, hey, since this is rising my tide and my boat, I'm not going to forget about those who are helping me raise this same tide.
We're and that's rowing what the
those
boat.
Coaches were... How about building a boat? Let's go that far. But yeah. To that point, all surrounding parties, all of us are intimate with collegiate sports. We know about it, been through the experience. Just a year ago, I was out to dinner, and I saw one of my childhood friends who's now a coach on a big-time program, and I just chopping it up, you know, real quick. Said, what you doing here? He says, oh, well, one of the top recruits in the country. I said, oh, yeah, you're going to get him? How's that looking? He said, it depends on if we're going to sign to 180. I said, sign to 180? I'm thinking it's some new deal. He's like, that's the minimum price to get this kid, 180. Are we signing up for $180,000? This is just a year or so ago. So the point of it is, all of us know how this looks when you peel it back. It's just unfortunate we wanted to single out these individuals who really are not the biggest culprits in this scheme.
I thought Christian's line on that was, you know, it's got a lot of depth to it. And I think what you want out of these coaches who are making huge sums of money, $6 or $7 million, is some care for the player. Now, ideally you say, hey, I'm going to share in this wealth. But I also think the coaches need to be cognizant that by sharing the wealth, you can ruin the kid's career. You take the kid in the movie, Brian Bowen Jr., who was supposed to go to Louisville. His father made a deal with Adidas to get him shipped to Louisville. He ended up never playing college basketball, having to go to Australia for over a year to get his career back on track. Didn't get the opportunity at a real education. I know that can be farcical to get an education, but I think the coaches that try to really help the kids do that do a little bit better. And he had to really struggle just to get back into the NBA for a couple games before everything shut down. So as much as you say, hey, pay the players, coaches should pay the players, the rules are the rules, and the rules can really hurt a kid. And I'm not defending the rule, but this is the reality you have to live in. So you can hurt a kid by saying, I'm going to give you $10,000 a month. It's a very, very complicated thing on what a coach should do, because obviously they get it when they're making millions and the kid's not getting anything.
All right, let's end on this note. Marcellus, start us here. Amateurism to me seems to be on life support. You got laws coming from California and other states. that are going to infringe and let athletes benefit in the marketing deals. How much longer can amateurism last?
If you run the mental projections, you would say a decade, maybe maximum. Look at it, the Power Five conferences, super conferences. We're already hearing those rumblings and those things being created right now. And it's going to undermine sooner or later, once they have that power, that solidarity, what we know as the NCAA right now. Kind of going back, if you're a historian of these type of things, you could go back to the AAU days in different sports where the AAU had their powers and how that was a competing interest with the NCAA. And we know NCAA has prevailed in that. So just in those considerations of looking at the NCAA as is, I think a decade from now, we're going to look back and say what the NCAA used to be. It's going to be different.
I think it's weakening. I think this is one of those things that it's going to stay and then fall all at once. And I think a thing about the scheme that is good, I don't think anybody watches it and comes out of it with a greater appreciation for amateurism. I think a lot of people would learn more about how ridiculous this concept is. And look, you don't have to pay the college athletes. That's a straw man that the NSA wants to do, because it's very complicated to design a system that would pay all the athletes. What you do is what the Olympics did and allow athletes to cash in on their name, image, and likeness. That allows Michael Phelps to swim in five Olympics. That allows Simone Biles to make tons of money and come back and train. It allows Usain Bolt. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. They've earned that money. And if they were able to do that here, it would be no problem for Adidas to pay a kid and say, hey, we'd like you to go to Louisville. It would be no problem for Christian Dawkins to serve as a kind of a middleman to set these things up. Adidas and Nike see value in these players. It's the NCAA and amateurs that are saying, no, you're wrong. Well, capitalism is going to work in this country. It's going to happen one way or the other. So I think amateurism is on its last legs, but the National Collegiate Athletic Association is going to white knuckle this thing as long as it can, because they want to control all the money. They want to get as much revenue in, and then they decide how to distribute it out.
Dan, I wish that the NBA and the NFL would somehow partner with the NCAA, figure out a way to pay the top talent while still in college, because I think that benefits the NBA and the NFL. I want you to think about this, Dan, though, because, again, Dan is the best sports writer working probably in the past decade. Here's something I want you to think about: the impact potentially of the coronavirus on college athletics, because I think it's going to be far more complicated post-coronavirus or in this coronavirus era to get the college system working the way it used to work. It'll be easier, I think, for the NFL and the professional leagues. And so I think you might start seeing more kids, the talented ones, choose an XFL or the G League, or is it the D League? I can't remember, D or G League, whatever they're calling it now in the NBA. I think you may see more people choosing that route. If the money gets slightly better, you're going to see some 18, 19-year-old kids choose the XFL over college sports.
I would agree with that. I think it becomes more appealing as it goes. I also think the colleges are going to have to really struggle for money. They're losing money right now. And if this thing, and this is the last thing I want to hear, and I know you two either, if this stretches into football season and there isn't a football season, every one of these schools is in a lot of trouble financially. And so it's going to contract a lot of things. College athletics has spent and spent and spent. They're just swimming in money. They don't pay taxes. They don't really pay their athletes. And they've had all these cable deals and everything. When that goes, and now you're no longer growing, but you need to maybe cut some staff or cut back on things, it's going to be very, very intense in what goes. And so I agree with you, Jason. What we come out of here with may not be the exact same college system we went into the coronavirus with.
Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai. All right, time now for Darnell Smith's question of the day. All right, take it away, homeboy.
Yes, sir. Let's move to Dallas, where our guy Jay Glazer is reporting the Cowboys have signed former star defensive end Alden Smith to a one-year, $4 million deal. Smith has been out the league since 2015 with major substance abuse problems and legal issues, derailing a promising career. Smith is now sober, but needs Roger Goodell to reinstate him in order to get on the field. And if he does, I want to ask you, do you guys think a guy could be an effective pass rusher after being out the game for 4 years?
Oh, absolutely. Man, we all know that youth is wasted on the young, brother. And what I'm hearing right now by the signing of Alden Smith and him being only 30 years old is that he's going to have a different approach to the game, and that's going to affect his production. Now, the assumption is it should have a positive effect on the production, but there are no guarantees. But let's make sure we understand approach versus production. I'm not certain how many sacks he'll tally once he gets back on the field, but I'm certain that he's going to give himself the best chance because we have to first start off when Alden was the man, when Alden was setting NFL records for his first 2 years as a starter and having over 30 sacks. What was Alden Smith's approach to the game then? Certainly it was immature. Certainly all the issues that he got caught up in and the DUIs and everything, the domestic violence, wasn't a good approach, but he had production. And I think between the time that he played last and now in these few years, he's had an epiphany. Oh, I know how to take care of myself better. Oh, I know how to rest better. I know how to approach the game, study harder. All those things which will make him a better pupil, a better student. But there's no guarantees it's going to make him a better player because Tiger Woods tried to clean up his life as well. And it ain't the same Tiger Woods that we had before when life was in shambles. So I'm looking forward to seeing how this experiment works because it's worth the risk. It's worth the gamble to see if his better approach adds up to better production.
Yeah, I think everybody's going to be rooting for Alden Smith. Listen, I remember Alden Smith as a kid at the University of Missouri and just unbelievable talent. When he got to the NFL, just unbelievable talent. A freak of nature, a wiry guy, a bit of a Javon curse, but maybe not as long. But to see this guy use his walk with faith and his belief in God to clean himself up and get this second opportunity, I think everybody around the National Football League will be rooting for him. I think he'll be a positive influence in that locker room. And I think, you know, coming out and maybe giving the Cowboys 15, 20 snaps in certain pass rush situations, yeah, I think he can be an effective player, and he doesn't have to be on the field all the time to be an effective player. I'm certainly rooting for Alden Smith and agree with the Cowboys taking this $4 million flyer on Alden.
Yeah, if you look at it too, man, just to help people conceptualize it, Howie Long always talked about where's your prime. And I think a lot of us think your prime is when you're 25 to 30. But Howie broke it down where you walk into the league, you're at a physical peak and you're at a mental low. And there are two elevators that are constantly doing this as you continue to play. And when they finally meet, that's your prime. And it's different for everyone. So hopefully Alden could be in his prime. You're 30. You can still rush the passer physically. But if mentally, now you've matched that physical ability, you got something special here. And then you look at it, his D-line coach from the 49ers, Jim Tomsula, is now the D-line coach in Dallas. So a little familiarity there as well to help him go. Let's see.